Welcome to Globally Speaking, a podcast dedicated to unlocking global understanding. Join us as we engage with experts and innovators who are reshaping the way we connect with global audiences. Whether seeking to refine your approach, wanting to expand your understanding of AI and its role in transcending global communication barriers, or just curious about the intricacies of global content, this podcast promises to enlighten and inspire.
Hello, and welcome to the Creative Series of Globally Speaking podcast. I'm Stuart Davison, Creative Director at RWS, and I'm very happy to be joined today by James Murphy, Founder and Creative Director of Hocus Pocus Studio, and also the creator and executive producer behind the Ready, Eddie, Go children's TV series. Welcome, James.
Hello, Stuart. Thanks for having me.
To kick off, I'd like to learn more about Hocus Pocus. And as the founder and creative director, could you tell us a bit more about Hocus Pocus Studio and what type of content you are creating, and also about the range of the type of customers you're working with at the moment?
Sure. So we set up about 5 years ago, 2019. We were all part of a bigger agency group before, but wanted to go independent so we could have a bit more control over the sort of projects we wanted to work on and initiate and the sort of clients we were working with. So with lots of hope and ambition, we sort of set up narrowly just before COVID. Great timing on our side. And our first client went bust, actually. So that was another particularly challenging thing in the beginning, but we got through that just about. Originally, we were doing animation studio fare, you know, lots of B2B films and some graphics packages for broadcast, which is how we started off. We did lots of TV, BBC TV food shows we got known for some reason, doing all those sorts of Great British Menu and those things. But what we really wanted to do right from the beginning was to try and get involved in creating our own IP. To a certain extent, you don't really know what a studio or a business is if they're just creating other people's content. So we wanted to really develop our own ideas and see if we could have a go at doing some long format IP work. So that's really what is the majority of our work at the moment. Certainly, we're working on a series called Ready, Eddie, Go for Sky Kids, which is a preschool show for young children, step-by-step guide to everyday activities. So getting a haircut, trying new food, all those sorts of things. So if you're a parent, you can look down and see all the list of episode titles and you can say, oh, you know, that one sounds relevant. You know, my little one could have some help with that. The kicker here is that the boy, the protagonist at the heart of it is autistic as well. So he wears it fairly lightly. You know, he's verbal, but it just is a prism to help us see just how challenging some of these extra activities can be for neurodivergent children. So, you know, we always wanted it to appeal to everyone. So, you know, all sorts of kids will watch it, but particularly helpful it's been, I think, to young autistic children as well. It was we wanted to do it because of personal experience with lots of people in the project, and there's just absolutely no content like this out there. So that's now in its, we're just finishing making the second series now, which each season takes about a year. So that's 26 episodes of 7 minutes each. So it's about as much content as a feature film nearly when you add it up like that. So to say, you know, we didn't know what we were getting into in the beginning, I have to say. It's a huge undertaking. You've probably got over 40 people over the course of it working on it to get it all together. I liken it to a bit like the Deer Hunter, where they're all off at the wedding before, you know, no one really knows what's going to happen. And then you suddenly cut to, is it De Niro or someone in the jungle, and he's there in the swamp. So that's a bit like it felt like after 3 months of making this show. You know, now we know much more what we're doing. We're familiar with the content. Sky have been, the shows on Sky Kids, actually, Sky have been a great partner and were very supportive, particularly as we were a fledgling studio in this way. So, but it is hard. No one prepares you for how hard it is compared with making a, you know, 90-second explainer or something like that. But we still love doing those as well. So we try to ride both horses, you know, to keep us fresh on both sides. So when we finish up in May, we'll be full bore going on the B2B content again.
It's quite a broad range, I guess. And it's interesting what you were saying about the Ready Eddie Go series, is that it's probably more than just a kids' TV show, isn't it? Because it's somewhat educational as well, you know, awareness for kids that, I guess, aren't aware of autistic children. And
yes, we don't mention specifically that Eddie is autistic, because that's not the sort of language that your five-year-old would be using at that stage anyway. But we definitely don't shy away from it. But ultimately, it's about representation, inclusion, and, as you say, education, which is relevant for everyone. I mean, you tell me any kids that don't need a bit more help trying new foods, it just so happens that particularly with some autistic children, that can be even more of a, you know, even more of a battle. And, you know, anything we can do to try and help a little bit with that is great. So I love, you know, SpongeBob and Captain Underpants and those shows, but we wanted to do something that probably had a sort of could work for some social good too.
Well, I definitely would appreciate if you could create another TV shows to get kids to eat more food, or a variety of food. That would definitely benefit my mob for sure. So my team's actually within RWS has worked with you and your team at Hocus Pocus on a couple of video projects. And I will say that your studio does have a unique approach to storytelling and that content creation. Who and what inspires you, and how do you decide on the kind of narratives you want to bring to life?
So to a certain extent, the most inspiring thing is just the basic commercial desire to stay in business, which sometimes when you're running a creative endeavor or a business as well, you've got to keep focused on that, because we'd love to, there's so many self-initiated projects we'd love to just work on the whole time, but we've got to keep the lights on, you know. So that's the first thing that sort of gets me up in the morning, really. I find London a great source of inspiration. I suppose you could say that about lots of bigger cities. I certainly find that I personally get energy from that, the diversity, the creative energy. So I think that's good. You probably said the same about Bristol, actually. There's a lot of our businesses down there, which would be great too. To a certain extent, the stories we bring to life, we originate, is focused on trying to do some good where we can. You know, right now that's something in kids' TV. We did a project for UNHCR quite recently, which maybe we can chat about a bit more later. And, you know, one of the most interesting projects we ever worked on was for the About County Lines for a Youth Offenders Trust, where we interviewed a load of people in the criminal justice system, younger people who are sort of trying to make their way in the world without kind of going down the county lines route that they were in before. So that was fairly harrowing, actually, to work on, but very, very interesting too. And, you know, those films had quite a lot of impact because they weren't judgmental or anything like that. It was just education, really, for social services, for teachers, just to understand, to let them tell their stories in their own words. And we used actors, voice actors who are from the literally from the Youth Offenders Trust program. So that was very real, probably the most real project we've actually worked on, actually. So those sorts of projects we love to do. I'm drawn to those. But, you know, equally, we've done a McDonald's commercial. Once upon a time, we did some films for Shell. I don't think we'd probably do those anymore. So, you know, I'm realistic about it. We're not just able to do work for social enterprises and stuff like that, but certainly what I'm drawn towards.
Okay, cool. Now, a previous guest on the Creative Series of this podcast had a great analogy, which was that creative content is made up of lots of ingredients. But I would add to that, you know, the people or the chefs behind it are what help, you know, take these ingredients and create, you know, very, you know, great content from all these different elements. Now, to deviate slightly, if language is one of those ingredients. How, in your opinion, how can language be as expressive as visuals when it comes to storytelling? And how do you balance visual elements with that linguistic aspect of a project, especially when translating or adapting content for global audiences?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. Language is so important with storytelling. As it's a little aside, actually, I only worked out recently. I did, like everyone else, did an ADHD test diagnosis recently, which I sort of just about scraped over. But one of the things that came up was about having an internal monologue, and I certainly do. I think in sentences to myself, and I kind of assumed everyone else did, but I'm told that that's not the case. And I was just even asking my family, and most of them didn't actually sort of think in sentences. So for me, that in the beginning of the word is absolutely where it all begins in the stories. So I see language as and visuals, graphics working hand in hand. I mean, animation is obviously a primarily visual medium, but the language alongside it, whether that's dialogue, narration, text on screen sometimes, which I love to do, actually, can bring clarity, personality, and help to enhance that emotion that we're looking for. So I suppose for global audiences, it's not just about translation, but making sure that it feels natural for them and engaging in every language. And that is very hard. So that might mean tweaking text or whatever to fit different cultural contexts, or making sure on-screen elements work across multiple languages. For instance, Ready, Eddie, Go was picked up by the Middle East recently. And of course, Ready, Eddie, Go is a punning title, and it doesn't make much sense in Arabic. So we were having a dialogue with the broadcaster there, and they're very understanding. They don't want to lose the point. They want to get it across, but we have to understand the local context of that and how that was going to work. So hopefully we've come up with something that works. We'll see about that. We're trying to create animation that will resonate wherever it's seen, if that's possible. So the stories, kind of, we're designing them particularly with the IP stuff with adaptability in mind, to make it so you can balance what's local and what's universal. So we keep text out of all of the episodes, for instance, and animation's kind of obviously easier to dub. So as that goes, Eddie is now Ready Eddie. I call it Eddie, but I should be calling it Ready Eddie Go. Is now starting to sell overseas. So at the moment, you can watch it in Australia and Finland and across the Middle East and Canada. But hopefully, it'll go. It'll make its way to South America and hopefully get localized there as well, so we can get the content out to the biggest audience that we can.
So what steps do you take to ensure cultural sensitivity and authenticity in your projects? For example, with the Ready, Eddie, Go TV series, you feature the authentic voices of children facing neurodiversity challenges. And how do you go about finding these actors in other countries?
So ideally, with a show like Ready, Eddie, Go, we insist on having authentic voices. So we're always going to cast an autistic lead, and we've happened upon a fantastically talented guy, Grayton Davis, who actually, as well as autism, we managed to get some ADHD wrapped up in there as well. So he gives this brilliant, because he had to be an incredible performer because he holds so much of the episode of the stories, and he talks to the camera a lot himself. So obviously we knew we needed someone who was going to be verbal, because you couldn't have a non-verbal actor voicing this role. But we cast him, and it was quite challenging and engaging in that sort of way, spending so much time with him, a couple of weeks in the sound studio getting it all down, because you get to understand all the bits and pieces he's coping with every day and how to just day-to-day life. So one night he might have not slept at all night, and then have to come in the following day to work. And one day he started taking his shoes off because he didn't want to have shoes on that day in the voiceover booth and all that sort of stuff. So he gives a great performance. And, you know, our goal would be to try and replicate that in whatever markets this is being broadcast in around the world and translated in. So as well as, you know, getting in the local language, we would always want to, as much as possible, kind of in terms of the neurodivergence and ethnicities, just to cast as we did in the UK.
Great. I guess authenticity leads me nicely into my next question. It's probably a regular topic amongst creatives at the moment, which is AI. So what's your thoughts on AI-generated voices? Do you think they are advanced enough or heading in that direction to completely replace human voices?
Well, they've come a long way, haven't they? Let's be honest. And they're definitely a useful tool in certain areas. So we've used AI voices for, you know, real rapid prototyping or animatics, or just laying out in a timeline, something like that. And I can also see for localization, that would be, you know, even testing that around durations of certain dialogue in a particular context. The ability to generate these high quality voices does have huge benefits, because you just got it right there on your desktop, rather than having to go to a voice agent, book a sound studio, do all that, which takes forever. That said, I don't think they're advanced enough yet to replace, and they won't be, human performance, at least when it comes to our type of storytelling, where emotion and authenticity really are first and foremost. A great actor will bring depth and nuance, and sometimes spontaneity as well. Jodie Whittaker is the... which you may remember her from Doctor Who. Actually, loads of other stuff. She wouldn't normally talk about that. She's in a play in the West End at the moment. She's a fantastic... She's a good example of someone who obviously has a very recognisable voice and style, but is someone who brings so much more when she's there. I mean, what these professional voice actors can get through in a day is astonishing, but also bringing their own nuances, kind of ad-libs, bits and pieces of understanding. That's why Jodie was so great with this project, that you were never going to, you know, you're never going to be able to replicate that with AI. So shifts in tone and emotional subtlety, that particularly in these sorts of things is very important, getting character and message across. So ultimately, I think, and I'd say this for picture as well, that I'd hope that it's a compliment rather than a replacement. Certainly helping us streamline workflows, offering possibilities for some localizations, I guess, and voice preservation. I don't know about that. That's another interesting thing, isn't it? I would like to say that it would be convenient for us to not have to go and do pickups back in the studio if we could just, even sometimes it's just a little line here or there where we're not trying to eat anyone's lunch. But, you know, legally, we are not allowed to do that with any of the contracted actors on this project. And, you know, we would probably wouldn't want to, but I would admit that sometimes wouldn't that be easy? I think ultimately, I feel that right now, human voices are still irreplaceable. And I would hope that that would stay for a long time. But what do I know? Everyone's talking about it at the moment. So let's see.
Yeah, I guess the thing is it's evolving so quickly. Like when we first started dealing with AI voices in our videos, you know, a while ago on the old Amigas or whatever it was, you know, you type in a thing and it would give you this very robotic, you know, sound output from it, you know, and even in the recent years, it's coming a long way very quickly. But there's still aspects that even with our team, we'd still prefer a human voiceover. When we're talking about product names and things like that, you almost have to trick it into saying it. It doesn't quite eloquently say the name quite how you want it. But there was actually a really good phrase that someone mentioned or said to me, and that was like, AI is AI until it works, and then it becomes software.
Yeah.
And I thought that was quite a nice sort of sentiment, right? Because at the moment it's almost there, but you know, and it's ingrained in a lot of our tools that you don't even know that, you know, you wouldn't appreciate them as AI anymore.
Yeah, that's so true. And everyone's trying to shoehorn AI into everything, even where it's not required or needed. I had a golf lesson the other day. I'm trying to learn to play golf, and my golf club, honestly, it said AI powered, and it was just like it was not AI powered. It was powered by a not very good golfer. But everything's trying to do it.
Yeah, that's right. So as a medium-sized independent studio, how do you keep pace with global trends in media and technology, and how are emerging trends like AI shaping the way you work? Like, does it allow you to be more efficient, or is it more of a, you know, some of your clients, I guess, asking you to use it? Or are they looking for that, you know, different approach to it? And I guess there's two ways. For me, internally, it's a very good time saver in some aspects. But it's more, as you said before, we're trying to use it as a tool to enable us to, it looks after the admin. That's how we like to see it. So we can focus more on the creative. So it takes away some of the legwork, so we can focus more on the bigger creative outputs. Is that sort of a similar thing for you guys?
I think that's definitely how it should be. I do feel, well, to a certain extent, I find it exhausting, to be honest with you, because the pace of change is relentless, isn't it? And you almost wish that, and I remember someone asking for it, might have been Elon Musk, for a pause in AI. He was probably just wanting everyone to pause so he could get on top of it all and buy whatever business he wanted. But I think a pause is something that would be useful to just be able to take stock of what's there, because there's this, you know, great FOMO, isn't there, every time you go to LinkedIn or some podcast or website that there's some tool or something you should be using to help you move. You know, I just want to move forward in a meaningful way rather than just for the sake of it. So we've always been, you know, had a real analog foundation to what we do in terms of, we do a lot of sketching and talking and, you know, writing. We still, you know, we probably shouldn't, but we still make loads of notes in PDFs and stuff like that, you know, in Word docs that go in PDFs. So we use Slack, obviously. But in terms of what AI we use in our workflow at the moment, not much, actually, really. I know that there are a lot of potential efficiencies to be made around the storyboarding animatic side, but that's, you know, when you're making 3D long format stuff, it's so expensive and time consuming. You've got to get that spot on. So all the layout and everything's done in, you know, sketching, really, where we get all the ideas. But effectively, it all gets sort of drawn over and chucked away. So definitely there are some savings we can make on that. I think next time, efficiencies, I should say, not savings. And, you know, some simple things like, you know, transcripts and stuff like that. Yeah, that's all done by a tool now in, you know, seconds that we would have had to have done before. And cues, you know, all the sort of stuff we have to supply back to the broadcasters, we do that. But in terms of the fiddly bits with rigging and a lot of the character building, not much yet, but I suspect that ask me the same question in a couple of years time and it'll be very different.
Yeah, I was gonna say also, you know, in the meetings that we had together, when there's things that we need to work out, you definitely need humans in that part as well to understand what we're trying to achieve, you know, from the video, and work out solutions. And, you know, AI, I don't think at the moment can solve that. I think there's still that sort of emotional intent that you need to get from some of this direction and from working with your team, you know, in these minor changes, whatever we're doing, there's that understanding of that, of the objective and what we're achieving. And they can go back and look for that particular thing that will make that video what we need it to be.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where AI, I mean, you see lots of flashy looking things that some of the image and motion engines are putting together, but you try putting a client into that who's, you know, or wants to cast someone who's looks slightly different or some of the nuanced stuff. And, you know, it's still a slot machine, isn't it? You can see some very impressive stuff, but putting that in part of a campaign that makes sense is, you know, that it's a long way away from that. I can't even imagine how it would ever work, but I'd probably be proved wrong on that. I think ultimately, you know, I do just hope that AI becomes a tool that empowers artists rather than replaces them. You know, we've all seen that meme about, you know, I want AI to be doing the laundry and the shopping rather than writing the poetry and all that sort of stuff, which is so true, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, the experiences we've had, even if it's just extending a canvas or, you know, cutting something out in Photoshop, there's some things that's definitely headed in the right direction. And I don't actually appreciate how much time that saved me in terms of these small little admin tasks, you know, in the day-to-day jobs that we do. But you're right, you know, it should be there doing the things we don't want to do so we can do the things we want to be focusing on. It's our not servant, but it's our helper to enable us to do that in that respect. So your recent collaboration with Troy Brown and UNHCR involved cross-cultural collaborations with diverse creatives. And so when working in that scenario, how do you ensure a unified vision and collaboration across borders?
Troy, he's an incredible artist to work with. You know, he's got a very distinct art style. I'd recommend anyone listening go and have a look at his work. It's kind of collage mixed media style, and that's his thing. So to a certain extent, the creator, which is unusual for us, we'd often be originating the creative, but much like if you're working for a big business and you have to go along with their CI and art style, that's what we inherited, his art style for this. So that was his thing, and there was no way that was going to change. So, you know, it did help that we loved it. It's very distinctive. So we didn't have to think about that, if you like. So once that's so clear and we had a kind of unified vision about what was going to happen there, that part was quite easy. You know, like lots of really good artists, he's very focused and direct, but, you know, still open to collaboration with us because we ultimately were directing the animation. He was the art director. So, you know, in the instance, this was a great project about helping refugees get skilled to be able to sell crafts for Made 51. It's called a really, really great project. So the concept behind the whole project is unifying, to use your terminology, is, you know, war is bad. Helping refugees is good. So even I can see the sort of black and white bit of that. So really, when we were handling the animation direction, we were, you know, collaborating, but kind of sharing using those traditional tools that we use in our workflow, like Slack mostly, and little calls like this, sketching bits and pieces. But it was pretty easy, actually. But that across borders idea, I mean, the border between us is between London and the Black Country, because he's actually based in the Midlands. But that could easily have been someone in America, South America. This happens very often with us, actually. Animation's always been quite a global industry, I think. We work with clients and talent and partners from all over the world. So strong communication is vital with that, whether it's the production pipelines or all cloud-based, of course, and real-time collaboration of actually, you know, sometimes sketching stuff out live while we're doing it on a focus time. And really, you've got to be sometimes, when we've been working with our clients in America, you just have to be flexible on the time zones a little bit, which can be a bit more challenging. But we've put quite a lot of effort into making that seamless, because quite frankly, we have to. So having a clear process, you know, setting out in the beginning what the clear process is, you know, not someone managing feedback, you know, so you've got a structured feedback loop and
so
everyone knows how that's going to work and you don't get bottlenecked by the geography and time zone. It does help that animation's quite visual. I can't begin to understand how software developers or something do this because I just don't know how it works. But, you know, we're sharing storyboards, previs. So it's easy to do that without being in the same room. You know, it's something you can share and critique that way. But ultimately, these things come down to relationships, I think. And that will be because often when we're working, for instance, with RWS, you're working with a sometimes quite a big internal brand team, art team, video. You know, most big businesses have internal video teams as well. So we don't want to be too precious about anything. So it comes down to trust as well, I think. If you trust someone, you want to get the best out of them and not kind of micromanage everything. So we try and keep communication open and make sure the expectations are clear from the beginning as well. So it feels like a shared creative journey rather than in isolation, if that makes sense.
My perspective is there's no point in hiring an agency if you're not going to use their talent, right? That's the whole purpose of their they're experts in their field. And you want that out from an internal agency. You want that outside-in approach. Because I think we're very good at you doing that outside, inside-out. I think, you know, the agency will give you that unique perspective, which I mentioned earlier. It's that different opinion of who you are and how we go out and represent ourselves to our customers. I definitely agree with that. That relationship is definitely important.
Yeah, I'm interested in that just generally as to, I tend to think of it as cyclical because we're quite sensitive to shifts between businesses are always keeping stuff in-house. Then the management consultants will come in and say, we want to lose some overhead to give that out to an agency. And I have found in the last, since I've been doing that, that it goes around. At the moment, we seem to be quite heavy on businesses doing a lot more in-house, particularly in terms of video and animation production. But I don't know. We'll see how that goes over the number of years. Perhaps that's a trend that will stay.
It tends to go like that, though, doesn't it? So it's in-house and it's outsourced, in-house, outsourced. It kind of seems to flow. In depending on what's happening in the environment, I guess at the time.
I might be applying for a job with you soon, then, Stuart.
Yeah. Now we want you where you are. You know, we'd like that unique approach. So hopefully that's not the case. Besides the commercial success of what you do, what other factors do you consider measuring if a project has succeeded, especially when it comes to cultural impact or audience resonance?
This is the tricky part, isn't it? So on one hand, you know, we want to focus heavily on engagement metrics, what people are doing, audience interaction, particularly with social media conversations or whatever. For us, it's trying to codify the more ethereal, you know, real emotional connection, if you like, we're trying to get around. So I'm sure Sky will look at the probably daily or weekly the viewing figures and the broadcast figures, which aren't shared with us actually. I know Netflix are now as part of the deal with the unions, they have to release their figures now, but unfortunately for Sky we don't get to see what those are. So we look more for how content is being viewed online on social media. And, you know, particularly with Ready, Eddie, Go, we've had a lot of audience feedback in terms of stories that people have shared, video clips about. There was one girl who'd gotten in touch or parents had gotten in touch with us because she hadn't had a haircut, but she had a lot of anxiety around going to the hairdressers, but had watched our episode on Eddie getting a haircut and the step-by-step approach had helped her. So getting an email in like that, that's where you've actually really helped to have a positive impact on someone's life. That is really, you know, incredible feedback. I wouldn't mind some of Cocomelon's metrics in terms of the hundreds of millions of downloads and views. sometimes, but equally those bits are really what you do it for, actually. On a quantitative level, we do track things like audience retention rates and how people connect with content over time, you know, particularly on the B2B side. Are people watching until the end? Are they coming back for more? All those sorts of things, which you'd be amazed with some of our clients who might spend 50,000 on a video and then not promote it or not be interested in what happens to it after. It's incredible, really. But that audience feedback, sometimes surveys, reviews, or, you know, we have direct conversations with viewers as well, you know, as part of research. So it's harder for the projects we're doing where we are, you know, our target is around representation and social impact. We have to look at how they're received by the target audiences. Do they feel represented? You know, particularly if you're making a film, as we did, about refugees, you know, we didn't want that to be in some sort of Soho media echo chamber, if that makes any sense. Are we making any actual difference in the end about how certain topics are perceived? But for us, the success is about creating something that resonates meaningfully. So if that's through an emotional response or a conversation, even, that's a great thing too, or a real world impact. For instance, we made for Ready, Eddie, Go at Christmas, we rewrote Silent Night with neurodivergent children in mind. You know, something like Christmas is great for most of us, but for some people it can be one hell of a difficult thing to deal with. So we had a conversation around that. We got quite a lot of media and did re-recorded the song with Paloma Faith, who wants to be in on the project for that. So that was a really interesting example of how something that lived beyond just the animation that we made and ended up by being a song, you know, that we didn't even need to make a picture for.
So, James, thanks very much for joining us on Globally Speaking, especially on this creative series. It's been great chatting to you and hearing all about, you know, Hocus Pocus and Ready, Eddie, Go. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.